Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. When U.S. soldiers moved into the southern Iraqi cities of Karbala and Najaf, they were told to move very carefully. They are, of course, under orders to minimize the number of civilian deaths, but they were also told to treat the local shrines with extreme care and respect. You might remember late last week in Najaf, for example, there was that brief misunderstanding. Residents thought a local imam was in some jeopardy, and the response was swift. Locals rushed towards the soldiers. The matter, of course, was soon straightened out, but the cities and the shrines of southern Iraq point us to some fascinating stories. And we thought we'd take the time to tell one in this hour. It might start like this. Once upon a time, in a land far, far away from here, there was a man called Hussein. Not Saddam Hussein. This one, this other Hussein, lived more than 1,300 years ago. He was a nobleman, a great religious leader. And the story of his bravery and the gruesome battle that eventually led to his death is a story that is told time and time again. It is more than a classic tale of right versus wrong or virtue versus corruption. It is the story which explains the Islamic respect for the martyr and the original division between Shiite and Sunni. Now, Connection listeners, we'd like to hear your thoughts on the story of Hussein as you enjoy it with us this hour. Why is it still so important today? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. And with me today, two people who know this story well. Zainab Al-Sawaj lived in Karbala between the ages of 15 and 20. She left in 1991 following the failed uprising after the first Gulf War. She's now executive director of the American Islamic Congress in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and has been here before. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And joining us from the NPR studios in New York City is Peter Chalkowski. He's a professor of Middle Eastern Studies at New York University and an expert on the dramas that each year retell the story of Imam Hussein. Peter, welcome to the program.
I'm very happy to be here.
So, let's go back to that time in the early, early years of Islam. I guess we're talking about a time, if we're telling the story of Hussein, that's barely 50 years after the death of the Prophet Muhammad. Am I right?
Well, Imam Hussein was the grandson of the Prophet, and the tragedy took place in the year 61 of the Muslim calendar, which corresponds to 680 of the Western calendar. And there was a new caliph in Damascus called Yazid, and he wanted Hussein to pay allegiance to him. But for Hussein to pay allegiance to Yazid would be to compromise Islam.
We should say a little bit about Mr. Yazid. He was a bit of a playboy, a bit of a glutton
Yes, indeed. And well, the whole story is the question of the religious and political tension between the Sunnis and the Shi'is, and Yazid, indeed, he is a bad man, and he is a Saddam of the 7th century, and so Hussein moved quickly to Mecca, and from Mecca he sent his envoy to Iraq, where his supporters used to live. And he got news from Iraq that he should come, because there are quite a number of his supporters. So his local supporters, his family, his wives, his children, they embarked on a trip from Mecca towards Kufa, which is in southern Iraq.
This is some kind of epic journey in the time. We're talking about a midsummer caravan right across the desert, aren't we?
That's indeed, yes. And, well, Yazid had a very good intelligence service. He had very good spies, and he knew very well about the movement of Hussein. So he sent his troops to intercept Hussein, and indeed, on the first day of the month of Muharram, in this year 680, 61st of Anno Hijri, Hussein and his group of supporters and family were intercepted by the soldiers of Yazid. There was a sort of a steel around him. They were surrounded. And for next 9 days, there was a physical and psychological pressure on Hussein so that he would pay allegiance to Yazid.
Let me just interrupt you there for a minute, if I can, because Zainab, of course, knows the story as well as you, Peter, and certainly much better than me. The period of time that these 72 people were encircled by the army of thousands.
That's right.
That was on the site of the city that we now know today as Karbala, the city
where
you
lived.
Is that right?
It's when Karbala, the city taking place now. And at that time, it was not a city. It was by the Euphrates. And this is how they refer to it. And the name of Karbala means Karb or Bala in Arabic. Karb means
sorrow.
Sorrow. And
it's the place of sorrow and misfortune.
That's
right.
And so this is the name of the city came.
I just wanted to bring you in, Zainab, because you were saying that each one of these days of the tension as Hussein was encircled by this wall of swords and spears, each one of them is important in the retelling of the story every year. Am I right?
That's right. Every day, especially the first 10 days of the first month in the Islamic calendar, Muharram, we have the first 10 days, they are Shia Muslims mourn in these 10 days, but actually they have the first 2 months of the Islamic calendar, which is very holy for them and very special.
All right, let's go back to Peter Chalkowski. That one of the nights I was reading on the weekend, Peter, one of the evenings before the battle, Hussein is said to have prayed with his followers and said to them, "Put your trust in God, know that man is born to die, that the heavens shall not remain. Everything shall pass away except the presence of God." It's a pretty dark prayer for the night before a battle.
Yeah, well, yes, indeed. He knew that they were to perish. They were about to perish. However, what is very interesting in the tragedy of Hussein, which is considered to be by the Shi'is as the greatest tragedy in history, it actually goes into meta-history and assumes a sort of a cosmic dimension by endowing the martyrdom of Imam Hussein with a sort of an immortal quality independent of time and special consideration. What is interesting is that, well, we know from historically speaking that on the 10th day of Muharram, which is known as Ashura, that the enemy attacked and within a very short period of time, everybody was killed. Hussein and 70, but according to tradition, 72 males. However, what is interesting in the tradition is that it is divided into many, many, many days of battles and suffering. So Hussein actually sees his brothers, his sons, his supporters being killed one after the other. It is only at the very end when his tiny little son, Ali Asghar, who according to tradition was between 3 and 6 months of age, that when he is killed, then he goes to battle. So it has a sort of an epic proportions.
Isn't there, Zainab, a point in the fight where Hussein holds up his young child almost in supplication to say, how could you possibly kill
a child?
And what happens?
And then they killed him. They killed that child. And Imam Hussein, after he saw his child being killed, went back and he knew that this is the end and he would he died the next day, or he's been killed the next day.
I just wanted to ask about his half-brother, Abbas, because he's the one who's supposed to have gone running for water or galloping on his horse for water to the Euphrates.
That's right. He went to, because they stopped them from going to to drinking water. So his whole family and the supporters are with him are thirsty, and they cannot get to the water, to the Euphrates. So Imam Abbas went to get some water, and as he reached there in his way back, they shoot him, and he's eventually killed.
So we have the valiant death of Abbas.
The tradition is that actually he was the greatest fighter, the standard bearer for Hussein. And he goes to the Euphrates to get water, and on the way back, His arms are cut off, and he still fights with the sword in his teeth. What is very interesting is that Abbas is a special beloved by women, whether that would be in Iran or in Indian subcontinent. If a woman cannot conceive, she would pray to Abbas. There are many rituals connected with Abbas, Abul Fazl. He also has the name Abul Fazl.
One of the rituals is
which I like very much, called Sofre. In other words, women take a vow that they will prepare a meal, and they cook this meal, and then on the appointed day, there is a special person who comes and sings and tells the story of Abbas. Then everybody adds to the story. Then the food is distributed among the poor. And I have seen women who couldn't conceive, and once they took a vow to Abbas, they did conceive. So it's an extraordinary. If you would like to establish a company with me, so that would be Dick Gordon and Peter Chalkowski, we would appoint Abbas as our partner, so that you wouldn't cheat me, neither would I cheat you. So Abbas is the guardian. Abbas is that an extraordinary fighter.
Peter,
I want, if I can,
to take you back to the battlefield, because we have the entire group, 72 family, friends,
followers.
Well, this
is a tradition.
They're apparently trampled by horses right into the soil of Kabul, and something awful happens with the head of Hussein.
Well, according to Tabari, once everybody was killed, they ran the horses over the bodies, they trampled, and they cut off their heads. And that was a tradition. There is nothing unusual, but they cut off the heads to carry those heads on spears to Damascus, to Yazid to Caliph Yazid in Damascus. And, then, finally, the bodies were buried in Karbala, and Hussein was, and his head, well, it was carried to Damascus. Later, it was found in Cairo. There is a mosque shrine in Cairo where his head is supposed to be buried.
Zainab, why is it? We have to go to a break, so I'll ask you to be brief. But why is it that this one battle, this one man, is so important in an understanding of Islam?
Because Shia think that he should be the successor or the caliph after the death of his brother Imam Hassan, and this is also in Prophet Muhammad during his life, he pointed as Imam Ali, Imam Hussein, and Imam Hassan, and his daughter Fatima as his Ahl al-Bayt, means the people of his house.
So we look back to this story as the original split between
Sunni and Shiite,
and that's still retold in that way today.
That's right.
All right. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. When we come back after the break, we're going to talk about some of the startling modern-day implications of the way people continue to experience the horror and the sorrow of that particular story, and we invite your calls. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. In this hour, a chance to look back in history, over 1,300 years back in history, to the original battle for Karbala, in part because Karbala was again in the news over the weekend with the Army's 101st Airborne Division winning a rather lopsided battle against irregular forces in Karbala after 2 days of fighting and a according to reports from reporters who are there, people are just now beginning to come out of their homes in Karbala to see whether or not the change in government or the peace being promised by the United States is genuine. The people in Karbala feeling a little burned because, of course, in 1991 they were promised the same sort of change in regime. It didn't happen, and there was terrific oppression at that time. With me on the program, Zainab Al-Sawaj, who was there in 1991 at the time, and joining us to talk a little bit about the connection between the old story and the city today. Peter Chalkowski is a professor of Middle Eastern Studies at New York University and an expert on the dramas that reenact the Battle of Karbala and the death of Imam Hussein. And Peter, I thought maybe I could start with you there, because a number of years ago, when I was working as a reporter and doing some sort of meaningless political story in Pakistan, I found myself outside a Shiite mosque at that time. And I had never seen such a large group of people, I'm talking about thousands and thousands of people, in such misery. They were men and women and children, all weeping, genuine tears, nothing ritualistic about it. And I was appalled. I thought it was a funeral. I thought maybe something awful had happened. And it wasn't until some time after that that someone explained to me that that was the telling of that same battle that we described. And when you were talking about this... Go ahead.
In Arabic, there is a proverb which is "Kulli yom Ashura wa kulli ard Karbala." Every day is Ashura. That's the day when Hussein was killed, and "Kulli ard Karbala," and every place is Karbala. So, in other words, this is particularly in the month of Muharram, there is this identification. Now, the people of Kufa invited Hussein, and when he was surrounded by Yazid forces, they didn't come to help him. So they betrayed him. Mm. And now they want to fight with him for justice. So in other words, they want to identify with the suffering, with passion of Hussein. And that's why you have so many rituals. What is interesting in Pakistan and India is that every Shi'i wants to be buried in the vicinity of Hussein's tomb, because this is the gate to paradise. So that's why many, before the war that is between Iran and Iraq, hundreds and thousands of Iranians would settle down in Karbala, hoping to die over there and buried. The others would write the wills that after the death they should be carried to Karbala and buried. But those people on the subcontinent, Indian subcontinent, for geographical, economic, political reason, it's simply impossible. So what they do, if you can't go on the ziyarat, on pilgrimage to Karbala, you bring Karbala to the subcontinent. So they bring some dirt, some earth from Karbala, sprinkle it on the local place which they bought, and that's going to be a local cemetery, and the local cemetery that will be local Karbala, where people will be buried. If you don't have the mausoleum of Imam Hussein in India or Pakistan, therefore you create it. So they built this mausolea, sometimes three-story high. And although they have photographs of the real one, it's not a replica. It's the artistic creation. And then, particularly on the 10th of Muharram, that is on the Ashura, they carry it or wheel it in procession. And there are the influences also of the Hindu religion. So sometimes...
There, Peter, before we get a little bit too lost in the intricacies of the religion. And I want to bring Zainab in, because Zainab, on another trip where I was fortunate enough actually to be in Karbala, I was struck to see at where the road comes closest to the shrine, taxis and cars coming with coffins on the roof.
That's right. What? This is people, the Shiites would like, Peter just mentioned, they would like to be buried in Karbala next to Imam Hussein. So they bring all bodies, sometimes not from all over Iraq,
like but from Baghdad, from Basra.
They prepare the body, and they bring the coffin, and they go to the mosque. They go around the mosque, they pray on the body, and then they bury it in Karbala or in Najaf.
It must be a huge cemetery.
It is. In Najaf is the biggest cemetery in the world. This is it's a huge as much as you see is graves and tombs there, and not only people from Iraq but people from all over the world actually asked to be buried in these two cities in Basra. In Iraq, Karbala or Najaf.
Now, Peter, you spoke earlier in the program about the sort of immortal quality of time, and I was just wondering whether or not retelling of the story that
because it is integrated into the stories of ancient prophets found in the Quran. So we see, for example, Adam mourning his separation from Eve. And it's very interesting because what happens, the tears from his eyes, of Adam that is, were coming down like a flood. The tears from his right eye were forming the Tigris River, and those of the left were Euphrates. And suddenly Adam is told, no, your tears is nothing in comparison with tears of 70,000 angels at Karbala who every Thursday evening they cry for the death of Hussein in preparation for Friday, for that would be in remembrance of Hussein.
That's right. So, also on every Thursday in Karbala, if you're in the city of Karbala, you see thousands and thousands of people come from all over the area in Iraq. And they go and they spend the night inside the mosque in prayers, and most of them, you know, crying and weeping because of the remembering Imam Hussein.
Can you explain why it is that a battle fought so many hundreds of years ago and the confrontation that happened so many hundreds of years ago still produces so many tears?
For Shiites, they are being most of the Shiites around the world being discriminated because of their beliefs, and they are minorities, and in these countries. So remembering Imam Hussein and his battle is resembling their suffering and their struggle to exist and keep their tradition in the recent days.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Boston. Ali's calling in. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Dick. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I wanted to point out something during the conversation that you're having this morning. A lot of interesting stories being told. And one thing, however, is that all of these stories have implication in today's policies and politics. In fact, the creation of Shiaism in Iran goes back about 300 years after the incident. And I'm sure your guests can elaborate on that. I'm not going to get into it. However, in the 1980-1988 war with Iran, as you know, Saddam's last name is Hussein, and Hussein got killed by Yazidis.
Mm-hmm.
In Iran, they changed the name of Saddam Hussein to Saddam Yazid in a way to further the war and to get the soldiers even more excited about the war and put them in the same situation or similar situation as Imam Hussein. Unfortunately, it does sound a very good tactical battle plan, PSYOP operations, whatever you want to call it. But over a million people died in this war.
Yes.
By using these stories and telling it to the way they want, the Safavid Empire in the 17th, 16th century was able to uphold its boundaries against the Ottoman Empire. That was the creation of the Islam, the Shiite in Iran. And I don't think we should lose the fact that there is a limit. How long are the Shiites supposed to pay? How long are the people in the world are supposed to pay for a story that happened 1,300 years ago? How many more people have to die? The creation of the in Lebanon, in South Lebanon, with the Hezbollah, how long more does this have to go on? How much of this even has to do with the Islamic Revolution in Iran?
Well, Ali, I want to take that point because it's one I know that Peter has studied at some length. Peter, just the way that Ayatollah Khomeini back in the 1970s actually built the...
Actually going back, not 70s, but in 1963, he started his revolution not in 1978, but in 1963 on the Ashura day, on the day that Hussein was killed, because he knows very well that that very day, I mean, the audience thinks differently.
Mm-hmm.
And that's precisely, it's removing this space factor and time factor. And that's why he was later arrested and then kicked out of the country. And he settled down in Najaf, and he lived in Najaf for 14 years and only a couple of months in Paris on the way back to Tehran. But yes, indeed, it is used for whatever political, social, cultural reasons. Yes.
Does that mean
paradigm of Kerbala is used and reused?
Does that mean it's exploited?
It is exploited. There is no doubt about it. Yes, it has been exploited. It has been exploited by Khomeini when he made an equation between the Shah and Yazid. You had the revolution rolling. Here it is the question of making an equation between Saddam and Yazid. What is very interesting is the fact that there are very few people who are known in history by the first names. And it is because Saddam Hussein, he has such a beautiful family name, Hussein as a family name, not as a first name. Therefore, he is known as Saddam only. And then, as Ali said, yes, the equation between Saddam and Yazid. Yes.
Zainab, the idea that the story is exploited, is this something that...
Well, in 1991, when, for example, the uprising happened in Iraq, I was in Kerbala at that time, and people took Imam Hussein's mosque or shrine as headquarters for the uprising. And from there, they were getting all of this energy and to fight against Saddam Hussein's regime, and from the power of this story or the power of Imam Hussein from the shrine, and this has kept them going until the Saddam Hussein's forces approach Kerbala and approach the mosques and start shooting at them, and many of them died in that mosque. They said, "We will never leave the shrine. We never leave Imam Hussein, and this is we will be with him. And he died in the soil, and we will die in the soil." And so the forces destroyed these two shrines inside Kerbala and killed the uprising back then.
But isn't it also true, Peter, that Saddam Hussein himself has tried to take advantage of the shrines, putting his image on the shrines, even naming some of his weapons after
later, like he changed even the flag of Iraq. Before it was only in three colors and three stars, but after the war was Iraq, he added Allahu Akbar. He also tried to put his face on in Kerbala. However, you see the problem is, we didn't help them, the uprising, because there was a Saudi pressure. There was a fear that the Shi'is of southern Iraq are going to join with the Shi'is of Iran and make a sort of a superpower, a Shi'i superpower. Like we also were afraid of the Kurds, that the Kurds declare independence, and then you have a domino syndrome with the Kurds of Iran, Iraq, and Turkey. So yes, it is within the framework of politics. One thing I would like to add, that almost every Shi'i, when he prays, and he's supposed to pray five times a day, he has a seal. And the seal is made, it's like a little cake made of the dirt of Kerbala. And the most important moment during the prayer is prostration. And during the prostration, a Shi'i puts his forehead on that seal from the dirt of Kerbala.
Our number
is 1-800-423. There's always a connection.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Houman, who's calling in from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Houman.
Hi, Dick. How are you?
Fine. Thanks for calling.
I'm born a Muslim, and I've lived in this country for about 25 years now. I'm not a practicing Muslim. I think it's about time that all these fanatic Muslims move on. And
from what to what?
To the 21st century. It's enough. I mean, how much are you going to mourn these characters? I mean, fine. They suffered. They contributed to the religion, learn from it, accept it, honor them, but move on. What I mean, in Iran,
But in Christian terms, are you saying that Christians should, like, you know, forget about Bethlehem and forget about, you know, and ask the people in Jerusalem to forget about the temples, that just leave all these things behind?
No, not to forget about it. I mean, to honor it. But they have such an attachment to it. Every year, for instance, in Iran at the time of Ashura, they beat themselves. Some of them shave their heads and they cut themselves over the head and they bleed. I mean, what does this get? I mean, I don't understand this.
Zainab.
That's right. These some of the traditions that it's been going there. Many of the Islamic leaders issued a fatwa to stop cutting themselves and bleeding themselves during these rituals. But people think is necessary and they want to do it and they believe in it. So it's even whatever the imam is saying or whatever fatwa has been issued, people feel connected with that story and they don't want to leave it, and we cannot control that.
Dick, you should go to the island of Trinidad and see the Ashura Day in Trinidad, and this is like a fiesta. It's extraordinary. There is a mixture of carnival and Ashura and a lot of music and marches and art. Fantastic. So that's slightly different what you observe in India and in Iraq or Iran.
Houman, back to you.
I think this world suffers from a lot more serious problems. We have environmental problems. We have diseases that are wiping whole populations. I think these people need to get away from that and try to progressively move into the 21st century and start contributing today to this earth.
Zainab, are the Shiites in Karbala dwelling too much in the past?
Well, in the past, but in the recent years, they are not being able to practice or to do any of these rituals because of the government, and that's stopping them from that. And Saddam Hussein's make every effort to stop these kind of rituals. And even in whole Iraq, for example, people cannot do any taziyah or.
But you're saying there's a healthy side to the ritual.
There are some spiritually is good for the people, and they feel connected, and this is part of them. And the other side is the government is stopping them from doing all of these things. So it's creating a lot of tension.
Yeah.
And a lot of suffering for the Shiites, who they really would love to practice this. Not all Shiites, not all of them the same. Some of them are secular, some of them are religious.
We'll talk more about this when we come back after the break, what the fighting just this past weekend in Karbala means for the people there and their lives ahead. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Around the world, this is the voice of Bassem Karbali, singing of that long-ago battle in Iraq, the battle that took place in Karbala more than 1,300 years ago. And we'll talk a little bit about the passion plays that are associated with that. But before we go there with Peter Chalkowski, whose area of scholarship that is, Zainab, I just wanted to ask you about, you know, what we read in the newspaper over the weekend. Karbala jubilation cites Hussein decline. That's Saddam Hussein's decline. But in that city, even today, 2003, are people going to see the fighting in the streets, the defeat of Saddam Hussein in that city in terms of the battle?
I think people in that city, they have in their mind a lot of connection to the battle of Imam Hussein. And as I mentioned before, this is the same thing happened in 1991 when the uprising happened. It started as all of us, as people who they have been suffering under Saddam Hussein for too long. And then their connection with the suffering of Imam Hussein in thousands of years back, and they connect it and make it as their fight. Today, they see it as the same thing, and I am sure of it. And I spoke with family there, and they said, we are continuing our fight against Saddam Hussein.
You were talking to them just recently.
I spoke with them last week, and they are hopeful that this is going to be over and their city will be liberated soon, and so they can practice their rituals as they wish, and also they can be free and live in peace.
Peter, a little bit about the Tazia, the passion play. Is that a proper name for the way that...
Yes, it is a passion play, yes. And I'm happy to report that last summer, that is the summer of 2002, Lincoln Center Summer Festival, I had three Tazias from Iran being performed next to the opera house under the tent. And Peter Brook, who is probably one of the most famous contemporary theater men, mm-hmm. and Richard Chechner from New York University, they consider this one of the greatest performing arts in the world. It is a performance in which the public participates. There is, in the reality, although you have good guys and bad guys on the central stage, and the good guys are singing their parts and bad guys are reciting it. Good guys are dressed in green. This is the color of paradise. This is the color of Ahlul Bayt, the family of the Prophet. And the bad guys are dressed in red. Nevertheless, the public participates. The public actually becomes part of the event. And at the Vatican Library, there are more than 1,000 Tazia scripts which were collected by an Italian ambassador in 1950s. There are probably about 250 different plots in the Tazia, and it's still alive and kicking.
That's right, and also in many other parts of the world, that where Shia practice the Tazia in many different kind of forms and ways, here in the state or back in the Middle East or in Europe, also being practiced in many different ways, and in Iraq, recent years, they only chant. They are not allowed to do or perform any of this Tazia.
And what might be done in the Lincoln Center in the United States would, in fact, just take place in the streets.
If the people were permitted. That was before Saddam Hussein came to power. It was people used to do that in the street, and especially in the first 2 months of the Islamic calendar. But later on, they stopped these rituals, and it was not accepted to do.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Boston now, and Rafat's joining us on the phone. Hi, Rafat.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
First of all, I'm a Muslim. I'm a Sunni. And I have no problem. I have all respect for the real Shia madhab way and the scholars that follow this madhab this way. But my problem is when my brothers, the Shia, start mixing, bringing things that have nothing to do with Islam, that have nothing brought by the Prophet or by the Quran, by Allah and the Quran, or by the Prophet, peace be upon him. This is my problem. And this is what's causing the problem, that shifting people from the basics of Islam, the real issues about Islam, going to these rituals and these kind of ceremonies like the turba and the tazia and all that, that's shifting them from the basics of Islam. They have become ignorant about...
Well, what's the problem with the turba?
Sister, the problem with the turba is the Prophet ﷺ said it, that Ali, remember Ali who fought this group when the fitna starts, when his fight starts, this group of now the Shia at that time.
Rafat, it's Dick here. I'm getting a little bit lost, and I'm afraid a number of our listeners will be if we argue too much of the interpretations. Can you broaden out your point a little bit to sort of say in general terms what your objection is?
Gentlemen, Imam Ali, or Imam Hussein, they refuse this kind of treatment, this level that my brothers, the Shia, brought those two imams to. They fought this kind of treatment. And Ali, he fought them first, he killed part of them, and Hussein, peace be upon him, he for them, he, and he prayed to Allah.
Rafat, I need to know what your point is here. I don't actually want to go back and argue what happened 1,300 years ago.
Okay, my point is all the the brothers, the Shia brothers, are practicing all that have nothing to do with the basics of Islam, that have nothing to do with what Prophet Muhammad brought and his teaching.
We're not talking about the Prophet teaching here or the basic of Islam. This is a ritual. This is a tradition that the Shia is following. But if you're talking about the basic of Islam, we're reading the same Quran, we're praying the same prayers, but this is part of our tradition. And there is difference between the tradition and the Quran and Islamic law.
Peter, I'd like to just know from you, in your own academic study, when you're looking at the celebrations of either the Shiite or the Sunni, do you automatically, you know, sort of have to untangle the type of tension that we're hearing here?
No, there is no doubt. There's always a tension, and it has been for 1,300 years.
Yeah.
And that's the reason why the Caliph Mutawakkil in the year 850 destroyed Karbala tomb completely. This is why Wahhabis, who later established what is today the Saudi Arabia, in 1801, they came to Karbala by force. They killed about 3,000 people and again leveled the tomb of Hussein. That tension exists all the time. And that's precisely why in 1991 we didn't come to help the people of Karbala.
And Zainab, in 2003, when Saddam Hussein is removed from power, mm-hmm. are these tensions that are so much a part of the history still going to be a difficult part of sorting out the relations of people who all call themselves Iraqis?
I don't think so, because in Iraq we don't have this tension in a very high level. People actually participate, for example, in Muharram when we have the Taziyah. The Sunni and the Christians, our neighbors, used to come to us and participate in the play and be among us. In Iraq, there is no very big difference. People lived many years together, and they don't have, we don't have a history of civil rights, especially in the recent years. And,
the same as in India, where the Sunnis and the Hindus participate in the rituals, and also in Trinidad, where the Christians, Hindus, Sunnis, and Shis participate in these rituals.
That's
so
right.
There is a total harmony, and it's possible to have a total harmony.
1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Baton Rouge, Louisiana now. Majid's on the line. Hi, Majid.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Assalamu alaikum to brothers and sisters.
Alaikum salam.
I am calling concerning one caller named Ali called, and he kind of mentioned the Iranian and Iran revolution, and he said, you know, when the war took place, which was nothing but a naked act of aggression. It had at no point anything was referred to this schism between Shia or Sunniism. It was not never used. It was a naked act of aggression. It was people who were not even religious, with Armenian from Iran or Kalimis, which are also Iranian Jewish. They went to that war and fight the war because it was basically a naked act of aggression.
So what are you saying, Majid? Are you saying that the story was, in that case, simply taken out of context? We want to try and keep it on the focus of the original story of Imam Hussein.
Yes, sir, because Imam Hussein was a son of Fatima, which was the daughter of Prophet Muhammad, which Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam called him Sayyidatul Nasa'ul Alameen, which means the lady of all ladies, like Virgin Mary, mother of God bless Jesus, son of Mary, you know, same. And I just want to tell you the last prayer of Imam Hussein, which is, he said, O all merciful Lord of the universe, accept the humble sacrifice of thy Hussein. Hussein has submitted in thy way all that thou hast given him. If this son of thy holy prophet had anything more, he would have submitted that also to thou. But, O Lord, forgive the sinner among the faithful, O all merciful one. And this is what...
Majid, can I interrupt you here?
Yes, sir.
Do you still find that that story and that that prayer has a lot of power today? I hear it in your voice.
Yes, sir. Because, see, I'm going to refer to Surat al-Hajj in Quran, which is, it refers to the Bayt al-Ghadim, which means the ancient house, which from the time of Prophet Abraham goes to the Moses and Jesus and Isaac and Jacob. We are the believer in Torah, Bible, and Quran. There is no differences among us, and this is what Imam Hussein stood for. He said, the man in Kufa was going away from path of Quran, and I mean.
Let me, if I can, Majid, interrupt you, because Peter, you've made the observation that there are some striking parallels here between the Christian faith, between Jewish faith, between Muslim faith in recognizing these particular moments in history?
Well, from the point of view of ritual, when you look at the Christian ritual of the Passion of Jesus, further away you go from Jerusalem, the rituals are more grandiose. You go to Philippines, for example. In other words, if you are removed from the place where it took place, then you have to make up those rituals. That's why there are more rituals in Iran and even more in India, and then it goes to Trinidad.
But are you saying that the basis of these rituals can also be somewhat unifying instead of divisive?
Oh, yes, indeed. Yes. Yes, of course. It depends how we look at it. You see, if we recognize that Hussein was fighting for justice, then here we are. I mean, there is no problem if everybody will have the same point of view. But the point is that people have different point of view. And this gentleman from the south, and the war between Iran and Iraq, which lasted, it was a bloody war, 8 years, hundreds of thousands of people,
right.
People killed. First 4 years, the paradigm of Karbala was being used, but it was spent after 4 years.
Well, even so in Iraq, Saddam used it for the same purpose to fight Iran, and then he later on claimed that he's a grandson of Imam Hussein. So
the missiles he aimed at Israel were Al-Hussein.
And he used the battle to serve his own propaganda.
Can that be purged? His image on the side of the shrine, that the way that he exploited that, can that be removed?
Yeah, can be removed. And the other thing is he made a tree, family tree, and his name is the last name, and he traced back to Imam Hussein and the Prophet. So this is also to serve his own propaganda. Meanwhile, he was killing the people who they are participating in Taziyah or in any of these rituals.
Well, an interesting look back in history at how it's seen today. Zainab, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Zainab Al-Suwayj is Executive Director of the American Islamic Congress. Peter Tchaikovsky, thank you for your help.
My pleasure.
Peter is professor of Middle Eastern Studies at New York University. Connection listeners, just a note that if you go to our website, theconnection.org, you'll see a number of photographs, a gallery of photographs put together there illustrating the shrines at Karbala that we've been talking about on the program today. We had help from Kim Bachari, Darren Manoogi, and Brian Myers, and Carl Volker. Our senior producer's Tara Murphy. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.